wonderful. Those days and doing all the skits and all that other kind of stuff in between. And with any luck, which why that might pertain to you other than just being fans of that kind of stuff, we may actually be coming to a market near you soon. Which I only bring up because it would be an awesome opportunity for any haunt to capitalize on that kind of show in your local market as far as advertising. And them, that's not me. I'm not trying to sell you anything. But obviously, if there's a year-round horror hosting type show in your market, trying to hook up with the advertising part of that, that's a good thing. But we're going to get into that tomorrow with ancillary sales and how that makes extra money on your haunt. But today, we're going to do a lecture on super detailing and how to actually make your haunt look cool. How many folks here have like a year-round permanent location with stuff that's just built in all the time? Oh, excellent. You're all going to be okay. You're going to love it. Because one main focus of all of this is my main goal in all super detailing, all detailing on haunts that I've done, whether it's a built-in permanent attraction. I built with John Denley, who was in here before. The two of us have worked together for the past 10 years. So his haunts in Salem, or the attractions up in Lake George, and that kind of thing. Whether it is a permanent location or something that is stored in a trailer most of the time. The main thing that will set your haunt apart is permanence, or the look of permanence. The look of settled. The look of it's been there for a while. And that is one of the hardest things to achieve in a temporary haunt, especially built with a traditional, 4x8 flat system. Because where are you? Are you in a tent? Are you in a building? And the plausible deniability of walking in, the front door of what was a Marshall's department store, and now having it, oh no, this is a haunt. It's been here for a million years. So I want to go over some of those kind of simple things. Think about how to disguise that you are built out of flats. All right, and how to do that. Ways to do that is, the big way to do it with us is covering those damn seams so that they just don't see that. And covering those seams in ways that fit the proper theme of whatever that room is, okay? The simplest kind of things that, haunts that we built on console would probably be like, mausoleum rooms or, we've done full 3,000 foot attractions where it's nothing but crypts and hallways and mausoleums and, broken out tombs and stuff like that. And the little trick we have is after you've sponged your walls and you've done all that stuff, we simply go get piles and piles and piles of 1x3s and paint those separately and sponge those separately. And, every foot up of the 8-foot increment of those 1x3s painted a little mortar line. And we just keep tons of those around. And we use those as seam sealers over all the flats. And it's amazing how just little things like that will help. Also, you're running your stringers back and forth for support and everything. What we do is we do, for that kind of room, and we'll get to all kinds of other different rooms, we do crown molding. I use 2x6s for that. And I have a bunch of it, 8-foot, 4-foot, and 12-foot lengths. And same thing, I paint it up and sponge it, maybe slightly different than the exact colors, or you switch if you're sponging in like a base color and you're sponging in two colors. I'll flop around which one is the sponging color, which one is the base color, just to juice it up a little. And we'll start ringing rooms with the 2x6s at the top. It makes everything incredibly strong. And when you have the 2x6s around, I use 2x6s on edge for some of my stringers, and all of a sudden you've got what looks like, there used to be a ceiling in here, but there's no ceiling, so you're still going to be sprinkler okay, or if you're outside, you're still going to be not a building, which is the most important thing about it, that you build outside. So those kind of things, just think about when people really build stuff. What are the little touches? And the little touches and the little details, in theory, are all things that the normal average person or the normal average haunter wouldn't bother with. Things that make it look real. And how do we do that as inexpensively and as easy on time as possible? And for 20 1x3s and 20 2x6s, you've probably just fixed two or three crypt rooms. When you're doing those 2x6s, try and like cut one a little short, so that way you're staggering, you're not ending your 2x6s on a seam. You know, if you're buying 8 foot, you don't want to end on the 8 foot, you want to stagger them, kind of like how they lay brickwork and stuff like that, just to help with that strength. One thing on the, when you're running those Raptor things, it's a cool thing we do, is take all your scrap plywood and pull a right angle on part of it and just cut whatever on the other part. And on top of it, in any place, like, we'll make believe this grid system, but make believe that these aren't here, okay? And just this is here, and those are your stringers, okay? I'll just take these now triangles within a regular thing, and on top, put them in the corners. All right, and again, it looks like the ceiling caved down. Not going to fill up enough that the fire marshal's going to yell at you. On the off chance, again, if you're outside, well, that's where you can hang the flame pots, and they're not going to get full of water. You know, stuff like that, okay? So, if it's, you know, if it's make things like they've been there forever. You'll now have corners where you can spray cobwebs, even if you're outside, corners where you can spray cobwebs, it'll stay there. All right, you've given yourself a lot more surface texture, surface detail to pull cobwebs, spray cobwebs, do whatever. The other thing I want to talk about is a general theory is a lot. So there's the theory of permanence, there's the theory of a lot. And the a lot part plays on people's minds too, which I learned from just watching my favorite thing in the whole world, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Ride. And I realized in there, a queue line is almost as fun as the whole ride. And if any of you haven't been there, it's old, as if it's all Spanish dungeons and the pirates are locked up and there's little different vignettes as you go through. But what I realized all of a sudden, just, you know, had an apostrophe one day, was that I went, holy crap, they must have spent $10,000 on lights down here alone. Because every 4 foot was a big wrought iron carriage lamp. And I'm going, well, but the King of Spain would spend that. And it's no big freaking deal. And that's really how they would do it, right? You know, it's not like, you know, we all want to find the great thrift shop find or the great yard sale find or we can make into something. And having one of something is great. Having two of something so you have a cool light sconce on either side of a doorway is great. But if you can find things, even if they're a little more generic, if you can find things like, oh, I can go to every Lowe's and either they're clearancing these out or these are the least expensive ones. If I can get 20 of them, you know, that's when things start looking real. You know, and there's ways to, you know, if you get a smaller little carriage light, fine, then you take a little time and you use some spray glue and some cobwebbing or some cheesecloth on it and try and make them a little bit unique to your haunt. You know, because that's the only problem with going at Lowe's, well, so does homeowners, you know. But trying to figure out things like, I don't know, I always get, I guess it's called Scirocco. We used to call it Italian plastic, because I remember in the 60s, everybody's Italian grandma had it in their house. It would be that molded plastic, gold, like with now it has black in the nooks and crannies. And you'd find little pictures, like they'd be little triangular frames that had little cardboard pictures of butterflies or whatever. Or sometimes you'll see they're actually molded in, not to be picture frames, and they have musical instruments or fruit or like that. And you'll find them at yard sales for a quarter, you know, or some or thrift shops or whatever. I get them constantly. I always buy them and just put them in a box. Because they look like cheap little yard sale things if you just have a couple. But when you run them every 2 feet down a 30-foot hallway, it looks really, really nice. And it still probably only costs you the $30. You know, so there's a little patience in this kind of stuff too. But the a lot factor is, you know, how can we do things where it is a lot of stuff, and how can we do it on the cheap? You know, it doesn't matter if it's a big fancy haunt, money is money. You know. Also, obviously, if you're doing that kind of stuff, you make sure you go to old neighborhoods for yard sales. You know, don't, if it's a nice new town of big mansions, they're not going to have any of that crap. You know, it's not there. You need to be in places where it's up in the attic, and sooner or later they're going to clean it out. So, other versions of a lot, either online or you go to other conventions, or hopefully we get them here next year with us as well. Smooth on, teaches you how to make molds, how to cast some of your own stuff, things like that. I was talking to some other people earlier. You come up with your own, like the foam props that the dealers sell or the foam props that I sell, things like that. That's awesome and great and cool, and it's probably, to be honest, not worth your time to sculpt that, spend the hundreds and hundreds of dollars on silicone molds, all if you need a couple. You know, and first off, if you need tons, well, I'll sell you wholesale cases, so then it's not worth your time either. But if you have your own logo, or your own little thing you want, or a specific kind of skull you want, or whatever, okay, it is worth it for you, or find somebody within your group that wants to learn how to do that stuff, to make these little molds. You know, if it's giant, I don't know, maybe not. But if it's cool little accent things that are going to set your place apart, it is actually cost effective for you to do those yourself. If you need less than a dozen, it's not. You might as well just use craft foam and wood scraps and cut each one and make each one, you know, of its own. But once you're past a dozen, it's probably going to be amortized out where it would behoove you to learn some of those skills. You know, the sculpting part, actually, believe it or not, is the least important skill. Because you can find things to mold. You know, you can find things that, again, you can buy a wooden plaque. You can buy a little piece of craft foam. You can cut out a bat-shaped silhouette and glue it on it. You can take the hot glue gun and make spider webs go around. We all can do that, okay? But actually getting the little engineering part of our brains, because so many of us are creative, we got to get to that, I don't know, let's be scientists here for a while, and learn those silicone casting techniques. You know, you go to monstermakers.com or you go to smoothon.com, and they'll have all the different mold-making things for you. And if you need a bunch of these things, it's totally worth it. I had a friend of mine, my logo here, I am not a sculptor. I had somebody sculpt this up in clay in three dimensions, and we made a mold. So when I have columns or whatever in my place, it's actually my logo. I cast them out of latex. That way they're nice and flexible, and I can put them on whatever I want. I have this little nice plaster mold now, you know, and I need a couple more, and dump some latex in it, knock these things out, and boom, 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 because, you know, not only is that permanence, because it looks all built in, it's a lot, because I can put them everywhere, and it's also building your brand, which is another part of the ancillary sales tomorrow, but, you know, anything you can make special that says, you know, it should say a DW on everything for Darkwood Manor, or a DWM, molded together like it's on the front of a baseball cap or something, you know, and make a little plaque that has that, and you can use them everywhere. You know, put them on your trash cans. Put them everywhere. You know, so learn those kind of skills. Those are the kind of things that you should be doing in February when you're pissed off that you can't be outside building or in the workshop. All right, making these little originals is coffee table work while you're going, oh man, I wish it was Halloween. There's no good movies on. Even Monster Fest sucks on AMC tonight. You know, those are the times where you can turn yourself into a year-round haunter and work on all those kind of things. Okay, so we talked about permanence, we talked about a lot. I also want to talk about different kinds of things and different little things you can do. Always try and pick up some of these DVDs if you can. I know John was in here talking about scares. He also has some prop building and detailing things that we do on his DVDs as well. That seam sealing thing we were talking about, okay? You can do the same thing in a lab. You know, you can do this with PVC, you know, run it through your table saw and cut it in half, get the bigger stuff even. One thing we like to do on the lab for the seam sealing, and actually we use it all over the place, is we get that big drain tile. If you don't know what that is, you see it on construction sites, all types of big, giant roll of heavy black round, it's not really heavy, of wide black round corrugated stuff. And it has little slots in it because they use it for landscaping and it disperses liquid out into under the ground. And we use that and we cut that in half. And all of a sudden, you know, any lab or a science or a futuristic or an alien scene or anything like that, that stuff being so flexible and all that, you can bring it up for that, but you can just roll it all over the place and it really isn't expensive. You can get one of those big giant rolls for like 40 or 50 bucks. You're cutting it in half, so you're doubling it up. Don't try and hide that you're mounting it. Get the biggest washers you can with the tiniest holes you can. And just use your drywall screws right through it. Because once you start detail painting and all that, well, big heavy washers and bolts and all that, that just adds even more to it, right? So those are good. The PVC stuff is good, except it's always a pain in the ass to paint. That new spray paint stuff that's supposed to stick to plastic is pretty good. Another old theater trick before they had that kind of paint is to spray it with spray glue first. Also, I've done stuff, if you watch Tattoo, if you ask him, he did a thing at Comic-Con where they built a set while everybody watched over 8 hours. They built one room. And he uses the squirt foam, the expanding foam, on his pipes for really old and crusty. And it's definitely a don't let it puff up, keep knocking it down. So, you know, you put a little squirt foam here, a little squirt foam there, and you either have gloves or a nasty throwaway paintbrush. And as it starts puffing up, you just keep knocking it down and wiping it across, knocking it down and wiping it across. And as that works, it'll start doing corrosion. It'll look like corrosion. Because it'll just be that surface, how everything starts to rust and that top layer starts coming, it'll do that for you. One other thing I do in our labs with the same thing is, I take all my scrap plywood and I just cut it into rectangles, nice and square and true rectangles. I don't care what size it is. Take a little caulking or seam sealer and fill the grain around the edges. And then I do this same thing with the squirt foam. And all of a sudden I just have a big pile assortment of access panels. You know, and it's like, well, this is nothing. This gave me surface detail on all these flats, and I spent the $389 on the squirt foam. That's all I spent. You know, because if I don't have a paintbrush or gloves, I'll take a piece of 1x3 that's old, and I'll use that to spread it around. You know, you learn to use anything. But then all of a sudden, you've got just, you stagger them everywhere else, and it's taken that, even if it's just half-inch plywood, it takes that surface of the normal flat and gives them something, because you know they all freaking touch everything. You know, but this is plywood that's seam sealed and encoded and bolted on. Let them do whatever they want to. You know, they're not gonna do that. But as they go along and it's dark or whatever, they're gonna do this. And they're gonna feel all these different raised things. And it's a very sensory kind of thing. And they're gonna, hey mister, stop rubbing my walls. Well, you know, you're not gonna get them to stop. So you might as well give them something to touch that they're not going to screw up, you know. And it was made out of scrap wood, so on the off chance they do screw it up, I don't know how, you know, it's easy to fix. So, and those series of flats, and you know, you separate that 1x3, or you separate that piece of PVC and put that in as an access panel, you'll fill those seams, you'll do all that of it. That stuff works really well. Believe it or not, I even... on the job site, me and Karen, and we're just such losers. We will keep everybody's soda bottle top. We never throw them away. We even keep the lids from the squirt foam because they're just perfectly round and they're raised, and they take that PVC paint really good. And I can make a million dials and buttons. drill a little hole through it and a drywall screw. And I know I'll never be able to get any of you to hire me at big dollars to be your consultant because. You know I'm going to be in your kitchen garbage picking for parts. But those are all the kind of, it's like, you know, well, how hard is it? You know, you're working all every week, you know, every weekend for how many months or whatever to put your stuff together. How many, you know, water bottles or whatever you're going to keep? Well, just keep the lids. You know, I mean, really, some of these things with all the corrugation in the water bottles, I think you should be cutting those in half and sticking them on the walls too. You know, with half of the hose. There's another one. You go to look for that drain tile. I'm sorry if this is going to be a little random, but this is how many different things I'll be able to give you. When you go look for that drain tile, look in the aisle for the septic or sump pump liners. And what they are, they look sort of like garbage cans, but they're about this wide at the top and only this wide at the bottom, and they have like rings, like an African-American Michelin man. And you cut those in half and flip them upside down. And now all of a sudden you have this big techno-looking beehive thing. You know, you put the other one up there if you want, you know, just with some PVC there, and it looks like huge Bride of Frankenstein insulator kind of stuff for the lab equipment. When you're looking, go to Lowe's and look in the attic vent and insulation aisle, because you'll see that cardboard, and you'll also see like white styrofoam things to shove up in the eaves, okay? They also have plastic vacuum farm pumps. They're like 18 inches, well, whatever the eaves would be. So maybe they're 17 inches by 24. But they're all egg crate vacuum farms. And they're like $3. And if you went to Transworld and somebody's going to sell you spaceship size or lab size for 4x8 or whatever, it's going to be $150. And these things are all, you know, they're almost two, well, I think they're longer than 2 feet. I think they're going to be like 18 by 36. And they're just a couple of dollars. And you put, it's attic vent insulation. They're actually just like baffles. You know, because you want flow in your attic, you don't want it totally stuck.
I don't understand it right now.
That's beyond my pay grade. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, they're about this long, about that wide, have all these triangles and all this kind of stuff molded right into them. And they're $3 or $4. And boy, they're just instant instrument panels, you know, and instant, again, spacey things if you wanted. You know, if you're an indoor and you have a ceiling, whatever, just imagine. You can angle out corners like that with them. And it just looks like, you know, you cut one, they're real thin too, so you can cut them with scissors even. You cut one and you just have all kinds of wiring that hang out, you know, stuff like that. That's a good little tip that nobody knows about. The other weird one that we use for labs like that also is go over to the concrete aisle. And you'll find the things that are supposed to, the clear half-round covers that are supposed to cover the cutouts for your basement windows. And what are those? $10? And they're plastic, and they're clear, and they take paint great, and they are the best fake ventilator hoods you'll ever get. Just again, I've done them where I've just mounted them on the wall, a couple of PVC pipes coming down to support them because they stick out so far when you use them like that. And you hide some recessed lighting or some stupid tube lighting in there or whatever, and it looks like $1 million. Now, one thing to do all of these lab things, I know there's a whole in costuming and in science fiction fan, there's a steampunk movement, which is a very like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Back in the old day, because me and Karen are old, we used to call it Art Nouveau. And it's all about the rivets, it's all about the copper plate, it's all about this. Okay. So me and Kevin McCurdy, if any of you know him, have always loved that kind of look and loved that kind of lab. And we have spent years trying to work on the little wooden nubs that are supposed to go over a screw when you countersink it in, and using those to simulate rivets. And liquid nailsing them on, and epoxying them on, and all this kind of stuff. And they always fall off. I've about given up, especially if you're any part outdoor or weather sensitive. If you're indoors and you're not climate controlled, eventually they're going to pop off. Remember, when you're trying, if you're going to do that, always glue bare wood to bare wood with liquid nails. Don't paint all this stuff and then have, oh, well, I painted these separate. Let's go up. No, those won't stay. Try silicone to put them on. It actually ends up being more cost effective to just get bolts. Just get hex head, you know, as short as you can, because you know, you're not really holding anything together. As short as you can, bundles, boxes, whatever, hex head bolts with a screw in it, you know, slot or not, and just get the adapter to fit your drill gun. And whether it's your volunteer free helpers or whether it's your least expensive paid helpers, give one of them a drill gun with a regular bit in it for a pilot hole, and one of them a drill gun that has the hex head adapter on it, and just let a couple of kids spend an afternoon, you know, and put that through again. In the labs, we use the 1x3s as well, but instead of painting the mortar lines on them, we have all these bolts, so it looks like the plates that you would weld between big steel plates. And it's just like, nah, just let them sit there, just let them drill, one of them drill pilot holes, and one of them sink bolts. You know, the first time we ever did it was a lab that was three rooms, but it was about as big as this. Sadly, my wife did it herself, and this was back in the mid-90s, and she actually did it with a socket set. And then, you know, she would fly to California and beat up Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. It was not a pleasant time for either of us, so please use the, you know, back then some of the drill guns, unless they were wicked expensive, would not go all day putting these bolts in the walls. And back then, we also used big ones, because, well, we'll actually bolt it together. That's stupid. A couple of drywall screws will hold it up. Just get the bolts long enough that it'll hold into the 1x3s or into whatever you're doing. Okay, don't. The wood stuff is great for handheld props. The wood stuff is great for small little scientific equipment. But if it's going to be the rivet look you want on the bigger things, the wood ones are just not gonna, I see some nodding of approval. You've got things pop and spring on you and like, doesn't that look like ass underneath now that it's popped off? Because you've either got plain wood or you've got residue of liquid nails or whatever. Liquid nails, you see that in the gypsy room, one of them little boxes. All right, any questions so far? Any other ideas? Is there any particular kind of scenes before I just keep rambling with all of this? Any particular scenes any of you are having problems with or are looking for ideas for? Got your blank open books, huh? That's awesome. All right. Wrought iron. Everybody who has a pencil, take your pencil. R-O-T does not spell wrought iron. I do not care how many times Larry Kirshner writes it like that on Hauntworld. Webster does not check Hauntworld and does not believe him. It is W-R-O-U-G-H-T because it is wrought like in wrought from a forge, wrought like from the anvil of the gods, that kind of wrought. It is not R-O-T because he wants it to sound creepier. On a side note, just because you paint it black doesn't mean it's gothic. Just so you know. Because he got very mad at me one year because he was actually in his booth and he was telling somebody about buying the flame pots when they first came out, and you could put them in something big to hide that the pots were there. And the guy said, like what? And he said, like a gothic bowl. And the guy said, what's a gothic bowl? Well, just take a bowl and paint it black. Okay. The old pop world tape we have, like, and your gothic rail. No, those are 2x4s. Anyway, wrought iron. Wrought iron is expensive and hard to find if it's old original stuff anymore, obviously. Sadly, because of the economy, we'll deal with the politics of that later. Steel prices are up, which means scrap prices are up, which means stuff is getting yanked out of junkyards all the time. You know, I junk a hearse and I'm like, ah, geez, I should have grabbed that or whatever. It's already, 2 weeks later, it's already crushed somewhere. You know, first off, hearses are really heavy. But you know, any kind of stuff like that that they can do, they are shredding and they are crushing. And okay, good for recycling. It's probably good in the long run. You know, not good for us. So trying to go to old scrap yards and find wrought iron, old church gates, all anything like that, is still the best deal, but it's getting harder and harder. Right? Trying to build it yourself is not tough. It's just getting it wickedly elaborate can be tough. There's a place, Google decorative iron. All right, I think it's decorativeiron.com. If it's not, please email me and I will send you the link for this. They sell all the supplies. They sell the bar stock. They sell all the little curly cues for in between. And of course, most importantly, they sell the finials. And they have, the finials are the little fancy things on top that you want to kill your child customers with. They do, they deserve it. They have hundreds of styles. But they also have about a dozen and a half styles in plastic. And the plastic ones can be as cheap as 30 or 40 bucks a hundred. So what I usually do, if it's not going to be in a high impact area, is I go to Lowe's or Home Depot or whatever other lumber yard is trying to sell us crap and calling it straight, and find one by ones, usually in the little pre-cutter in the smaller thing, smaller wood area, and I build it myself out of wood. You know, if it's going to be on facades, if it's going to be up top or whatever, you don't need real metal. And now that these plastic finials are out there, you know, they have them with 1-inch square holes, with 3/4-inch square holes, so it depends on if you're, you know, when it's bar stock, I think it actually comes true, whereas the wood, it says it's a 1x1, but it's a 3/4x3/4, that kind of bullshit. So you want to be careful and measure before you order. But, you know, there's no problem with getting 1x2s and a whole bunch of 1x1s. And, you know, I actually hot glue them to tack them. And then I go back in either with a nail or a pilot hole and a little screw or something like that instead of welding. You know, if you want to get bar stock from these people and do all this other kind of stuff, one of those little tiny, like 110, no big deal, personal welders from Sears, we'll do this stuff. I mean, if you're going all day long, all the time as a living, obviously it won't. But if you're just wanting to tack stuff together to make some little thing for over an archway or whatever, and you really want it to be metal, little Sears guys will do you fine. And it's never bad to have one. Every haunt should have one of those around anyway for fixing spot welds. Not that any store-bought animation ever breaks. But just in case, it's nice the next morning to be able to just go, well, you know, I'm not as pretty a welder as many people, but at least it'll hold together again. So these are not, that's a nice little investment for anybody that's doing stuff to just have around. You know, it's nicer to do your own, unless you know, your auto mechanic is a friend and you can schlep stuff down there or something like that. But the wrought iron thing definitely seems to, in a lot of scenes, what all of us do, seems to kind of say Halloween. But you don't have to make it out of the metal. That one place will help you make it out of metal. Wood is often the way to go, okay? Yes, sir?
How can you treat the wood to make it look more like wrought iron?
Well, you should talk to it nicely. How should you treat the wood to make it
look more like wrought iron?
Excellent, excellent. Two heavy coats of black, and then just use, I use a burnt umberish brown and actually an orange, and learn some dry brushing techniques. Over that. Yeah, even though I built it fresh, I don't want it to look perfect black. You know, I had the opportunity to actually pull fencing from yards and stuff like that, and I go dry brush it to make it look less. You can still do that spray glue thing to get some corrosion on the corners and stuff if you're really going to be that anal about it, which we all should be. That's what this panel is for. Get some of that. But yeah, if the first coat is going to be kills, and then the second coat is black, obviously that's going to be good for sealing it. You know, to be honest, it depends on your budget. It depends on how often it's outside. You know, if you're going to do those kind of wood-treated things and it's, you know, going to be outside all the time, I leave a lot of my stuff outside all the time. You know, well, then you should put a coat of kills on it first. You should get in between the seams and, you know, just a quickie little thing, even if you're just using a toothpick or a Q-tip or anything, put a little caulk in between the seams. So, you know, moisture is our enemy. And all that kind of stuff. You know, and sadly, with all of this, you know, it's kind of like learn not to be married to the stuff you built, even though it's beautiful, because there's going to be wear and tear, there's going to be abuse, there's going to be, you know, and it's nothing unless you really are building it like they would have 100 years ago, and with that budget, it's going to last forever. You know, you have to sort of be resigned to that a little bit, I'm afraid. Any other questions so far? Nodding girls, that's why I'm never the one right after lunch, because everybody falls asleep on me after lunch. They have warm tummies full of food. Come on, throw out, yes, self, thank you.
For fencing, I use PVC and burning strips all the way across, and then I went and got this little garden plastic, little small. Black ones, and I just cut the bottoms off and attach them all across the top of the fencing to finish it off.
Yep, wait till
it all together.
Yeah, hit Walmart towards the end of the summer when they start clearancing that stuff out again. If you didn't hear, he's chopping up the short little 12-inch high plastic garden fence from Walmart and Target and all like that, and using that to decorate up what would otherwise, you know, could be just plain 1x3s and big PVC. So that's a good thing too. That's a way to get those things cheap. Everything should be parts to you. You know, the way to find these detailing things is nothing is good as it is. You know, roam around and look at shapes. You know, just spend time looking in the hardware stores for shapes. Like, well, that could be this, or that could be that, and how can I do this so it doesn't kill me, you know, time or budget-wise to actually do that. How are we doing on budget? Or we're probably only 3:30. Let's see, what kind of other? Okay, let's go into more Victorian type stuff then. All right? The rough part about Victorian, especially, you know, like if you're doing crypt walls and it's a temporary thing, if you go to the time to paint all the rocks and paint all that stuff, you can kind of hide some of the seams in the mortar lines. If you're trying, you won't be able to hide them all, but you can hide a lot of them. You know, and remember to do as much distracting as you can, too. You know, the best way to hide a seam like this is to have something mold that goes like this. Just draw their eye away from it. And when we get into Victorian dining rooms or the master's den or everything like that, it starts getting a little tougher because people kind of know what that, they have a better feel for what that's supposed to be. You know, I mean, walk around the hotel, you know, it's nice to be back on the East Coast where things are old and the styles are more colonial, and you'll see it like, oh yeah, people are around this all the time. So so things that you want to do then are still try and segment it off as, I guess, as much as you can. And the crown molding thing will still work. You're just going to run some stain on the 2x6s instead. You may do a 2x6 and then put a little 1x2 on top of it so it'll look a little more like milled woodwork, because trying to actually buy that kind of milled woodwork will kill you. And if you buy the fancy foam stuff that has all the really crazy stuff in it, it's not, it's hard to make that stuff last with tear down and set up your upgrade. You know, if you're in a permanent location, it's fine, go for it. But that stuff won't last and won't put up with the abuse after a while. So you might want to be doing wallpaper up top and wainscoting or paneling on the bottom. That kind of, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Sold to the lady with the CD hat. She moved her pen. So your support can come from what the chair rail is. You know, if you want to bind those flats together better, well, you'll be able to do that with the chair rail by actually only screwing the chair rail in to where you have uprights, you know, behind your flats. Again, making sure you skew it so you're not ending a piece of chair rail at the edge of the flat as well. All right? And what I've done then, too, is maybe not Victorian, a little bit earlier, you'll actually see big molding things in the middle of a wall. You know, and they like really, really fancy doors, you know, would blend in with that. Well, you can get away with that by if you have the chair rail here, right? Chair rail's going here, and you know we all cheat and cut it at 48. It's supposed to be at 32, but that means you have to cut twice as much, so none of us do it. So you do the chair rail up here, and that gives you your support. Well, okay, how do you hide the seams down there? Well, if you're not doing it, if you're doing actually paneling down there, well, it's fine, because they make it so that it butts up and it looks okay. If you're not, because what I usually do is I paint it black, I do some brown dry brushing on it to give it wood grain, I do some lighter brown, this and that, then I take a straight edge, and I take markers, and I put the panel lines in it. So then you can just put those panel lines wherever you want it to go. And maybe you can, you know, throw a couple more bucks at it and put a little baseboard of 1x3 that has some stain on it as well. So then up top, you still have that big seam, all right? If you paint or do wallpaper, and you can probably help hide that seam some, just because of the patterns of it. But thinking about that old, I think it's like a French revival, I don't really know what it's really called, of the big extra moldings around that, we'll just put that. You've got your chair rail out of 1x3, there's a seam here, because that's 4 foot, there's a seam here, that's 4 foot, right where the seam is in the wallpaper. So just bring it up, and bring it over, and bring it down again. And you'll segment, you know, that's an easy to do look, and you'll segment that. Even if you still want a wallpaper pattern inside, you know, it's really gonna be okay, and that should be either stained or should be painted nice color. And that way you can cut your wallpaper to just go inside. The hard part about having wallpaper on flats is the edges. So if the wallpaper is going under this trim, even when you disassemble this stuff, keep some of that trim over it, it'll protect the wallpaper's edges. Putting wallpaper on so that it looks like crap from the start. And this was a John Burton technique, so you know you could go to the dealer's room instead of his lecture. I don't know if he's talking about this or not. But he taught me this one. It is to use a roller, get whether it's pre-pasted or not wallpaper, use a roller and get wood glue, that brown icky wood glue. And even if you want to water it down so it goes farther, you can. If you roll that on the walls and use and put your wallpaper up on that, whatever is in that wood glue does not like paper. And it starts pulling and stretching and bubbling and crinkling the paper all by itself. Another reason you won't hire me as a consultant. Because I don't do that when people are around, because it looks like magic when they come back. You'll still be able to get in there and rip pieces of it and, you know, do other that kind of stuff. But first off, it's way quicker than actually pasting wallpaper. That part. My wife does that when we're on things all the time, because before I destroy a Victorian place, she decorates it perfect like she's Martha Stewart. And then she goes away. And then me and Denley go in there with utility knives and spray cans and claw hammers and like that and fix it. I mean, she actually cares about, she'll go out and swatch colors. You know, that kind of stuff. Well, we're going to use this green for this, so I think that burgundy was, and we're like, yeah, whatever. Welcome to have black drizzle on it by the time we're done. Whatever you say, dear, that's fine. So that's a good way to make the Victorian thing happen. And again, remember, especially in the Victorian thing, which was a very, very opulent era, the more light fixtures you can put on, the more layers of the decoration you can put on. Because usually, if we're doing a Victorian-style haunt, it is an old Civil War, you know, antebellum mansion that's fallen to ruin. Or it is some fake old thing that has a bunch of history to it and everything like that. Which means it probably was in your storyline or whatever, owned by Richard. You know, because the poor people houses, well, you know, row houses in Baltimore are not where people think of the row. You know what I mean? It's just, in our collective American consciousness, that is not what's scary. So we're usually doing things that would be much more of a much more opulent era and rich people, you know, because like, all of our ancestors were rich people, right? I mean, you go to Ren Fair and everybody's dressed like the freaking queen, right? The mudbeggars are paid to be there. That's not how we dress, because that's not my ancestor. Apparently. I don't know. I lost the lord title somewhere, apparently. So that's a good way to do the Victorian stuff, but again, remember when you put all those light fixtures on them to tarnish them down. I do believe John is going to talk about chemicals that will kill you and he loves to use to tarnish this stuff. So I will not go through that because I don't think my liability covers you. But at least learn the spraying, you know, the spraying and dry brushing and those kind of techniques, which are in any decorating book. Or in some of Boneyard Productions, scenery and prop building. DVDs as well. Does anybody here not know what I mean when I say dry brush? Excellent. Good. A different technique it is dry brushing, is burnishing. And burnishing is done to make stuff metal. Okay, where we're dry brushing, if you made a joint compound statue, it's always going to look like it's kosher. So I usually spray paint it black, or if I've gotten the joint compound dark enough, I leave it that color. And then you dry brush it with a medium gray, and maybe you dry brush it a little less with a white or something to highlight, and that's all good. Burnishing is still kind of the same technique, but what if, like the statue I have down on my dealer table, what if you want it to look like it's a bronze? All right, a little bit different. And I do a lot of fiberglass work instead of joint compound these days. That way all the stuff can stay outside forever. And the burnishing thing, how it works best for me, it's very similar to dry brushing, is I use styrofoam plates to put my gold paint. It can just be regular acrylic gold paint if you want. If you want to sprinkle the nice glazes, that's fine too. And a brand new cheap, crappy chip brush, you know, the real like raw wood handles and the cheap aluminum thing, and they come like from there up to 4 inches or whatever. Okay, a cheap one. And I'll get a little bit of the paint in the brush. You know, usually if you're dry brushing, you just want a little bit of paint on the brush. But on the styrofoam plate, I swirl it around. And I don't exactly 100% know how this happens, but it coats the bristles different than dipping your paint and wiping most of it off and dry brushing it, okay? And these glazes and these metallic paints have a different viscosity anyway. And I think that's part of it as well. And I don't dry brush. I actually spin it as I'm going. Almost like some of the little attachments you'd put on something to buff your car or whatever, okay? So don't be real regular, be very irregular with it. All right? And it's so dry with that kind of paint that I'm just rubbing and I'm spinning and rubbing and I'm spinning, and it really comes out metallic. And you won't be able, you have so little paint on the brush, you'll never paint in the nooks and crannies and screw it up, because that needs to be black, that's why it's cool and old. But give that, especially when we learned that on that Scirocco, on that Italian plastic. You know, because of course, we buy things that are gold, we spray paint them black, and then dry brush them gold again. Which is the lament of my actress, you know, hey, I need you to go decorate that. What color do you want, gold or silver? Gold. All right, so I have to paint it black, then paint it gold again? Yes, you can. Yes, can I just paint it silver so I feel better about myself? No, not in this. Which took me a lot. There's one I don't like, because that stuff comes gold. For years, I didn't like painting it gold because I thought it wouldn't look different enough anymore. And I would paint it silver all the time, but boy, it just disappears in all the crypt halls. You know, it's like I really wanted to try pulling different color and making things bounce off again. So even though all the pewter jewelry is cool, and you see all the, you know, other things that are, oh, look at that big silver thing. sometimes even in all the gray of all these rock walls that we do, whatever, doing it in silver, it just blends in. So I want to talk a little bit about the theory of why all this is important. The theory of this is important is because of believability. All right, we touched on that a little bit about why would people go to the bother of doing all this. I truly, in my heart, need to believe that even if you have a very dark haunt and you are chasing them with a chainsaw, that's how little I use chainsaws, I don't know what I'm saying, chainsaw all the way through, there's still something in our little reptile brain that says whether this is real or not. You know, and the more, especially in your opening couple of scenes, the more realistic you can make this stuff, the more they will suspend their disbelief because, of course, as we know, mortals are stupid. They want to go with, they don't want to think. They want their inner part of the brain to fill in the gaps and do everything for them. So the more input we can give them, the more we can fry those circuits. And their logic circuits aren't working. This is sadly why they turn into a stupid mob if there's a problem and run as a group. You know, in Pennsylvania, we all have to take classes and get certified as inspectors now, as haunt owners. I have my little card. I'm a ride inspector for the Department of Agriculture in Pennsylvania. Great. You don't want to know the amount of paperwork this has. And liability. But they gave us a little lecture on group fear and dynamics. It was very, very interesting about how even if they're 75% the way through the haunt and there's an emergency, they'll turn around and run for the entrance because that's what they know. And they can do study and study and study over this. So I'm sure that's the same part of the brain that I'm talking about, that they just want to go on automatic pilot. And I believe the more realistic you make their surroundings, the more on automatic pilot they will go. Now, you're going to find Halloween junkies and fans going through that want to look at all the details. And it happens to me, that's when even they get scared by the stupidest, easiest scare you'll ever do. Because they're just so distracted. I think props and detailing are the ultimate distraction. You know, ours is a guided tour. And if there's, you know, I've had people say, I love my haunt, I spend all this time on the money, and I do detailing, I really do, blah, blah. And they just run through and they don't see it. Well, okay, so they're not probably running through all the time. Nobody really runs through all the time. With my guides, if we build something cooler, just if there's something they like, all they have to do is just look at it as they're walking past. Trust me, most of the group will look too. You know, especially the guide, they rely on the guides to keep them alive. So if the guide looks up there, holy crap, what's that? Then that's what they'll think. The guide doesn't have to say that. They'll just automatically think that. You know, so they will look and they'll say, and that'll force them. They'll have to say, look at this. Ricky just spent $1,000 on that. My chicken prices went up this year. They won't say that. But they'll just casually look, or they'll brush their hand across something or whatever, and little subtle things to force them to look where they want them to look. And that'll just help feed into their little brains that, holy crap, I think these idiots are real. You know, I mean, I'm out in the boonies. I really don't get much vandalism. I really don't get much of anything because I actually think they're scared of us like they think. Around like they think, you know, we don't want to test this. You know, and I think even in a temporary haunt, in a location, in a mall, in a whatever, you can still get away with that. You need to really, really make sure that the front couple of rooms are good. Then if you need to, for budgetary reasons, make something a little, you know, if you don't have anything in there, don't light it real well. Like, I'm fine with that. I understand the black plywood wall mentality. But if you give them the first couple of rooms that are gorgeous, their little brains will also fill in between scenes. Halfway through, make sure there's something gorgeous again, and towards the end, make sure there's something gorgeous again. And, you know, light it nicely. You can still scare them in broad daylight if it's that, because they're going to be looking around, holy crap, look at all this stuff, what's this, you know? And somebody rolling out from under a couch will get them. You know, whatever, it really can, you know, we probably have more wattage per square foot, you know, of any haunt you'll ever go through. And it's really not a problem. It's a problem for me to get scare actors because they all think they're actors. So when the managers, like me and everybody, give up and put on a robe and go do the scares for the night, it's very simple because they will just be distracted by all of that. Any other questions so far? Any other scenes or any other styles you want to talk about? We can brainstorm a little. Yes, sir.
What graveyard detailing?
Graveyard detailing, excellent. The cheapest way to do a bunch of graveyard detailing is to actually invest in some of all the little wooden nernies and scrolly things that you'll find at Michael's in the woodcraft section, so that you can put all, and that's a great, you didn't hear this here, that's a great thing to mold, so you can have 100,000 of them, because they're expensive. But what I do usually is I buy those and I find little skeleton rings or bats or whatever, and I glue them on them, and then I mold them, so, you know, 10% copyright law, and they won't show you. But yeah, trying to find the carved stone and things like that that you can detail up. I try to do large mausoleums and large freestanding stones as much as possible that are made of something that I don't care if they touch. But then I try to fill in all the back corners. One graveyard detailing I like to do is the simplest little motorized zombie type things that you can ever do. I like to try and work the corner of their eyes with movement as a little bit of a distraction. Like those little, I guess they're supposed to be for like lightweight latex skulls, like spinning a motor from the top that just spins in a low revolution. So if I have a corner, I built a wall across this and cut an archway into it, right? I have a nice couple little wall sconces or something like that on either side of it. Well, there may be a zombie there, even if it's just a flat, it could be a statue, it could be anything that's, you know. But up there, I'll put that little motorized thing and just have something, you know, a spider's moving, a skull's are moving, stuff like that in there, okay? Because nothing should be moving in a graveyard. So the subtle little small things work out well. Years ago, Walgreens had them at Christmas. They were tree turners. I mean, I don't know what a Christmas tree turner is. But usually those are like 30 or 40 bucks and they go all the way around. This one year after Christmas, they blew out these tiny ones. It must have just been for little tabletop fake trees. And they only did 150 degrees. So they swung back and forth. Well, so I chopped off the heads of all my mannequins and stuck these things in their shoulders and put a little piece of wood coming up and, you know, squirt foam filled some really good masks. And again, they're in the corner. They're just stupid rubber monsters like we all do out of PVC. And sometimes they look good, depending on how you articulate them. Sometimes they look like hell. But if they're just here and it's just, guys, just, yeah, it's real slow. You know, I mean, if it's only 150 degrees, it is really slow. But there's little subliminal things like that that they do pick up on. They really do. And if they catch something out of the corner right there and they start looking over there, well, then your corpselator that's popping out over here scares the shit out of them. You know, because you spent $5 or $10 on this other thing over there just to start working them over, you know. As far as the actual set design, again, it's the amount of realism you can do. How many cool, different kind of marble painting techniques. You know, that's one thing I try to really do in cemeteries is not use the same colors for everything. Try and liven it up and draw their attention, because that one over there actually does have a green tint to it. You know, that one over there is based in light gray and then different color sponging. That one's based in black with different color sponging. Try to keep some of the bigger things closer to where they're walking. Like, I know there's a thing in town design, you know, city-fi design things of neighborhoods. You ever notice that when you're going down a street of row houses, they seem to fly by really fast, but when you're going through a street full of regular ranch houses, they don't. It's because they're set back from the road. And your eye has all that time with that angle to look at that one ranch house. Whereas if the row houses are right up against the street, like a downtown area, you're driving by and you can only concentrate on that one house for like that. So I try to have different colors of different tombstones and different sizes sort of close to where they are. All right, a couple of static zombies that are lurking around like this, like, you know, whatever. And as they do get a little bit smaller, you'll be doing that forced perspective thing a little bit too and making it seem like it's a bigger area than it really is if they're a little smaller, farther away from them. It's good to know I'm doing a good job. You okay? But different colors and different styles. If it's a really old cemetery, like our cemetery was started, my town is great, dead outnumbered the living 10-1. There's only 500 people in my town, there's 5,000 people in the cemetery. Not counting us. So it started 1880, 1920 or so, and you can see different styles. You can tell, for our area in Pittsburgh, you can tell where the Middle European migration happened, you know, where all the Polish and German people moved to our area, because the styles changed. You know, up until the Civil War, they still looked like old colonial tombstones in that cemetery. But then, you know, as the Industrial Revolution hit, blah, blah, all that kind of crap, you can see the change because they brought with them their European, their more modern, at the time, modern European tastes and styles. So why would they be doing what they want? So all of a sudden you go to that section of the cemetery and you'll see the little portraits of whoever's buried there, you know, which I never saw in New Jersey growing up. It freaked me out the first time. Like, oh my God, that's what he really looks like. You know, and he's been dead for 60 years. And that's what he probably looks like now. You know. So different styles of tombstones. Don't get all caught up in the whole, it must all be Celtic with a big circle cross on the top. No, those are good and creepy and tapping into the younger generation's gothishness of everything is Midnight Syndicate and everything is a Hot Topic poster and those are the styles they all see. So that's all fine. But different styles of tombstones will work out good for you. There's a set by us that we really like. We call them the fainting couches. And there's multiple, it's not just one family. They look like fainting couches with the big roll at one end and a roll at the other end, all out of stone, and there's no cushion in the middle, that's grass. And that's where they are. It's really interesting, they're really beautiful. And usually they're in family plots and they have, who by us in 170, they have nice, their own little fence and their own little whatever, and they're just laid out like this, is like, okay. You know, and those are pretty cool. Those are pretty creepy, and that's an easy one to put like a carry arm sticking out of, and things like that. Is that any help so far? But statues—that's the other thing. Not just tombstones in a cemetery. Statues. You know, if you go to really old ones, you'll find I think it's probably around 1870 to 1910. It seemed to be popular to do the big archangels. Do the Virgin Mary holding somebody, you know, that kind of stuff. Don't really make it look like the Virgin Mary, save yourself that headache. You know, make it look like it's just, you know, angels are a good way to go. And that's an easy one to do because you can get regular busted up lady mannequins. Go to Spectra Studios and get some wings. Fiberglass or joint compound the hell out. You know, get an old bag costume like a Grecian or a Roman goddess thing that you got at Spencer or Spirit Stores after Halloween for $20. Put that on the mannequin, joint compound that are fiberglass resin, you're done. You know, paint it up, you're done. Okay? And actually, if you want to really do the detail on that, the Spectra Studios rubber wings are great. Those feathered wings seem to be getting cheaper. I fiberglass resin right over those, you can still see the feathers. You know, you may not see every tiny little quill line, but you'll still know they're feathers and they look like a lot more than any of us want to sculpt. You know, and that way they can stay outside, because those are just like Elmer's glued to cardboard. So you got to do something with them if they're going to be, you know, moisture attached at all, let alone if they're outside. Yes, ma'am.
Fiberglass resin here.
Oh, you can get that at Lowe's. You can get it at Walmart in the auto department. You can get it at any body store, any advanced auto, anything like that over where they have the paint. Excuse me, the paint.
Like Bondo.
Well, Bondo is the thicker, goopier clay version. This is a thin liquid version. You'll get a square kind of can, like what you would buy paint thinner in, that shaped can, and you'll get little tubes of clear hardener. It comes with clear hardener in it. Be lazy like me, buy more hardener. And juice up the amount of hardener you use by a little bit so you're not sitting there all frickin' day waiting for it to dry. Remember that it does harden within 10 minutes or so. So either think about what you're actually doing. If you're brushing it on something, you want to use those crappy chip brushes again, okay? Once you get good, my Padawan, you'll be able to do a whole statue without losing a brush. Because the statue I have down there did take me 20 minutes to a half an hour to coat, but it never hardened until I was done. And it's a very zen thing, so it's not going to work the first time for you. But they give you a little cup or a little plastic cup that's of applied kind of plastic that the resin won't eat. Because if you mix it in a styrofoam cup, that's fine. You're going to have a fiberglass worktop. You eat through the styrofoam, you're just going to have, you've just now decoupaged your workbench. So they give you that. So you pour in some of the resin, you do sort of like what they tell you, and it's all mathematical on the can of how much hardener to how much resin. That's a pretty easy thing. Just give it a little extra 10 or 15%. And you mix that up, and you mix that up, and you mix that up. And if you paint and go, and paint and go, and just leave your brush in there, in 10 minutes you're going to have one of those spilled paint sculpture. But if you're going fast enough, and you're getting towards the end, but it hasn't started to harden yet, just refill it. If you refill it quick enough with more resin, a little more hardener, and keep working and keep your brush moving, it'll never harden. There'll always be enough fresh to dilute the residue of what was the old stuff, and it'll keep the brush from hardening. Okay, the brushes are $1.49, who cares? But it's more the effort of, well, everything does cost money, and the time you lose by, this is hardened, now I have to clean out the bowl, you know, or is it hard enough to clean out the bowl even yet, and start again, you don't want to do that. You want to just kind of get in the rhythm and just go with this stuff. Make sure you're wearing rubber gloves, because the more you paint, the more it's going to drip. You know, make sure you're wearing whatever you can, body protective, because it's nasty to get off. Okay. It's just fiberglass resin. It's technically polyester fiberglass resin. The fiberglass really is the cloth you would put down if you were repairing a car or a swimming pool or a boat or something. And it's the resin that then sucks into the cloth and hardens, which is why it'll work on those cheap costumes, because you're substituting the fiberglass cloth for that costume. You can do that with wigs. You can drench and soak the wig in enough to do that, and that'll harden up too. Again, wear two or three layers of the glove, because the latex gloves I've been buying lately, if I hit the corner of that crappy aluminum on that chip brush, it's going to cut it. So I try to, you know, long sleeves, and you know, you want to make sure you can't use it outside all the time. It needs to really be at least 65 degrees, 70 degrees, or it's not going to want to cure. And you don't really want to do it inside, because your spousal unit may kill you because of the smell. Because lots of people can get some nice headaches off of the fumes. So, you know, well-ventilated area, do it outside. You know damn well you won't, but I need to tell you. I'm going to tell you this.
How much does it affect the color or texture of what you're putting
the
out?
Fiberglass smooths out stuff a lot, that, which is why I use it when I want to do bronzes, because it kind of gives it that bronze cast look. Go down, again, I'm not trying to sell you the statue, even though I want you to all buy it. Go down and look, and you'll see that I use really heavy linen on that one. So it had a very coarse grain. I didn't use a costume, I just used fabric. And I cut it up and all that. And you'll still be able to, you know, feel it and feel that, oh, okay, yeah, if I was an asshole, I could actually snap this off. but you'll still be able to see, because I have little shreddies hanging on that one. And you'll still be able to see the texture in the cloth, you know, and that kind of stuff in there. And I kind of like that. It helps with the burnishing and kind of brings out some extra. How are we doing on time?
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. All right, well, please remember, if you enjoyed this lecture, my name is Ricky Dick. If you didn't enjoy this lecture, my name is John Burton.
Safari Anomalous is a vendor here, and they arrived super late. In fact, they just got the deal popping right down. So I recommend everyone go to the back vendor room and check out her product line. Excellent stuff. Safari Anomalous. Vendors here with excellent products.